edition of Sound Ideas, bringing you a candidate forum in the Democratic primary race for Congress in the 13th District. Good evening, I'm Charlie Schlenker. The primary election is 6 weeks away. Early voting starts this week on February 8th for some parts of the district, and somewhat later for McLean County because of a pending court case that we're not going to go into right now. Joining us at the Normal Theater are the candidates in alphabetical order: Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, Jonathan Ebel, David Gill, Eric Jones, and Angel Sides. Welcome all. Also joining us for this live broadcast is our audience. Thanks to everyone for attending this forum. The forum will feature questions developed by GLT News with input from those submitted at WGLT.org. There will also be time for opening and closing statements. This forum is co-sponsored by the McLean County League of Women Voters, Illinois State University College Democrats, the Normal Theater, and the Illinois State University School of Communication. The League's Becky Gropp and Reagan Rinciosu are serving as our timekeepers. We determined the order by drawing numbers with the lowest number going first, and after that, rotating among candidates alphabetically. We will ask as many questions as time permits during this forum. As moderator, I will call on candidates to make clarifying comments and pose follow-up questions as needed. That brings us to our opening statement, and the first candidate up is Jonathan Ebel.
Good evening. Thank you. You're going to hear a lot of talk in political campaigns, and I guess the central question that you should be asking yourself is, will a candidate back her or his words with action? I don't just talk about national service. I have worn the uniform of the United States Navy. I don't just talk about the value of higher education. I live it every day in my job at the University of Illinois. And I don't just talk about equality. I have actually officiated a same-sex marriage. So what you know about me, whether you agree with my politics or not, is that I have the courage of my convictions, which Rodney Davis clearly lacks. And that's what you should expect from someone whose only qualification really is his connections, who has only ever worked for politicians, and who is hardwired to not think creatively. Privilege me with this job, and your voices will sound in my ears, not those of political elites or corporate PACs. Privilege me with this job, and I will work every day to make you proud of your representative. Thank you.
David Gill.
I'm Dr. David Gill, and I'm a bold progressive Democrat. And my progressive message, single-payer health care now, a $15 an hour minimum wage now, and tuition-free access to public higher education and trade schools now, would improve the lives of virtually everybody that lives here in Illinois 13. And that message, it's not just a good message, that's a winning message. That message won in this district by 7 points back in 2012 when I last ran. And the voters had the misfortune that year of having a liberal independent on the ballot who split the vote just enough to allow Rodney Davis to defeat me by 0.3 percentage point. And I've watched since then as subsequent more conservative Democrats have been destroyed by Rodney Davis by 18 to 20 points. And I can't watch any longer. With this guy we have in the White House, we must have a Democratic majority in the House coming out of the midterms this year, and the surest way to have Illinois 13 be a part of that Democratic majority is to nominate me 6 weeks from today. Thank you.
Your turn for the opener, Eric Jones.
Hi, everyone. My name is Eric Jones, and I live in Edwardsville with my wife and two young sons. And my wife and I decided to take on this challenge and to jump into this campaign because our two young sons, when they're old enough to understand what we're facing in our country right now, we want to be able to tell them that their mom and dad did everything they possibly could to change the direction of this country. And I've been in these fights before, and I've dedicated most of my life to taking on challenges for everyday people. I'm a former Illinois Assistant Attorney General, and I'm also a former congressional investigator. And in those roles, I took on special interests that were hurting people. I took on a government that wasn't listening. And on occasion after occasion, we won those fights. And I'll tell you, I took those fights on, and I dedicated my career to this because I'm just a guy from a small town. My dad's a small business owner. My mom's a school teacher. And I've been taking on fights for people throughout my life. And that's what I'm going to go do as a member of Congress for you. I want to go take on these tough challenges and take the fight to Washington. Thank you so much.
You also have 1 minute. Angel Sides.
Yes, my name is Angel Sides. I'm a teacher and an activist, and I've been producing a political commentary on Free Speech TV for the last 10 years. I feel independent media is important because we have a corporate censored media that bamboozles the public into voting against their own best interest, and that is a complete subversion of our political system by major contributors. An oligarchy is what Jimmy Carter calls it. And anyway, I think we need to also get big money out of our elections. Pharmaceutical company contributes money. We have higher drug prices. The oil industry contributes money. We have global warming and pollution. An insurance company contributes money. We have higher premiums and votes against expanding Medicare, single-payer universal health care. So the Republican Party is the biggest corporate party, but if we're not in denial, we also need to transform the Democratic Party and get the big money out of the DCCC.
And our final one-minute opening statement comes from Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan.
Thank you. Thank you for having us tonight. My name is Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, and I am born and raised in Springfield, Illinois, and I've also raised my own family there. And I decided to get into this race the day that I saw our current Congressman Rodney Davis celebrating with Donald Trump and all his cronies on the White House lawn, the day that they decided to rip health care away from millions of Americans. My husband and I have raised three kids, and in 2009 we almost lost our oldest son, Jack. I know what it feels like to be terrified in the hospital, and I know what it feels like to be terrified when you're at home all over again by the bills when they start pouring in. I believe that health care is a right and not a privilege. I am in this race to defend our health care, to stand up for our middle class, and to fight back against Donald Trump, Rodney Davis, and this disastrous agenda.
You're listening to a special Sound Ideas and a Democratic Primary Congressional Candidate Forum live from the Normal Theater in Uptown. Ideas for questions for tonight's forum were submitted at WGLT.org. As agreed, each candidate will have up to 90 seconds to answer questions. If in the event of a follow-up question from me, you'll get 30 seconds for that. Carla Bailey Smith of Bloomington wants to know, what makes you the candidate best suited to win against Rodney Davis? And we will start with David Gill.
Well, as I indicated in my opening, I ran for this seat once before against Rodney Davis back in 2012. And my message of single-payer health care and a $15 an hour minimum wage and tuition-free access to higher education won in this district by 7 points. This is a wonderful district. By 7 points, the voters in this district voted for a candidate who supports a woman's right to choose. By 7 points, they voted for a candidate who supports single-payer, who supports aggressive action against climate change, who supports campaign finance reform and the public financing of campaigns. By 7 points, they voted for a candidate who supports marriage equality. And they just had the misfortune that year of having a liberal independent on the ballot. In years that end in a two, the one election after redistricting, then an independent can relatively easily get on the ballot. And in 2018, Rodney Davis won't have the protection of some liberal independent, and I think that I've demonstrated that I can defeat him handily. And I think that those are issues that I emphasize that speak to the voters in this district, whether they consider themselves Republican or Democrat. You have to have the ability to move tens of thousands of swing voters in this district. And whether it's my background working as a physician in emergency departments up and down the district, I've spent time in 5 of the 14 counties here. For one reason or another, voters have come to understand that I'm a man of integrity and that I do this because I care passionately about their well-being. There's no ulterior motive for me. And so that's why I think that I would be the best nominee.
Mr. Jones, why are you the best candidate to beat Mr. Davis?
So what I'm bringing to this race is a track record of fighting on behalf of people and taking on special interests. And when I talk about what I'm going to do, I'm also talking about what I've done. And what I want to do in this race is put my record up against Rodney Davis's. And on issue after issue after issue, I've been on the side of the people of this district, and Rodney's been on the side of special interests. Whether it was when I was in the Illinois Attorney General's office, I took on student loan servicing companies that were forcing young people to pay more in their student loans than they should be. What did Rodney Davis do? Nothing when the Department of Education rolled back all those protections that we put in place. I also fought on behalf of Illinois workers to take away these things called payroll cards, which were charging people fees just to take off money, just to access their paycheck. What's Rodney Davis done? Sided with the big banks and allowing the Trump administration to dismantle all the protections that were put in place following the financial crisis. Or whether it's on climate change. I took on the Bush administration for politicization of science and uncovered that they were, you know, executives in the White House, oil and gas executives, were editing science reports, taking out the word climate change, and putting in something else. What's Rodney Davis done on those issues? Absolutely nothing. I've been on the side of fighting for net neutrality. Rodney Davis has voted to take away net neutrality. I've also been on the side of fighting for people against health insurance companies that were spending too much money on CEO pay and not enough money on health care for people. And what's Rodney done? He tried to take away our health care. And so on issue after issue after issue, I'm going to be able to go up against Rodney with my track record and show that my interests have been there forever for Rodney. And I'll say one last thing. Rodney has talked about how he grew up working at McDonald's. Well, I can say, everybody, I worked at Dairy Queen.
Ms. Sides, why does the surest path to victory over Congressman Davis go through you?
Well, I think the first thing voters should look for when they vote for someone is, how is that politician funded? I haven't taken any corporate money or any money from super PACs. I think the second thing is, how long has that politician been saying what they're saying? I've been an activist for the better part of my life. So I'm not exactly pandering to the vote. I have actually held a protest in front of Rodney Davis's office having to do with the TPP. I've been arrested during Democracy Springs alongside Code Pink, the Young Turks. Wolfpack was arrested the day I was there. I've been traveling all over the country protesting all these pipelines being put in. I have marched and protest and spoke against the pipelines and fracking here in Illinois. So I'm not exactly pandering to the vote, but I think that's two things people should look for whenever they vote for any candidate for any race. I campaigned for Bernie Sanders, and based on the fact that he was taking small donations, and he has been saying the same thing for a very long time. And I think if everyone would follow the money when they vote, that he would be the president right now. He'd be in much better shape.
Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan, you're up. Why are you the best chance to take the seat from a Republican?
I am deeply rooted right here in the 13th District. I have, not only have I been born and raised here and raised my own family here, I've gone to school here. My roots are right here. And people will trust that when I go to Washington, D.C., I am going there to represent you. It's what I have always done. Whether it's been through advocating for children's hospitals or the group I co-founded called Women Rising, which recruits, supports, and elects progressive women to local office. I don't just talk the talk, I walk the walk, and I do it right here in the 13th District. And when it comes to health care, there is not another candidate who will take that fight to Rodney Davis and hold him accountable like a mother who would have lost her son, who would have lost her home, who would have lost her livelihood, if it wasn't for the protections that we have in place. I will fight back on health care. I will fight back on the taxes that he wants to impose. Just like I stood next to the grad students here at ISU in Westland when Rodney supported the bill that took away the tuition waivers from graduate students. This is where I stand. This district is where I'm planted. It's where my home and my heart are. And in 2018, this is a great year to have a woman on the ballot in Congress. So ladies, we got to pull it together and make sure that we take one more step toward equality in Congress.
And Mr. Ebel, you bet cleanup on this one.
Thank you. I think that you should vote for me because I am the only ballet dancing marathon running religion professor veteran in this race. Now that matters. Each of those things matter. I dance ballet not because I am the next Baryshnikov, I do it because it allows me to spend time with my children. As I said earlier, I live my values. All three of my daughters are deeply involved in ballet. I realized early on that if I was going to spend quality time with them, I needed to put on the shoes. I'm a marathon runner. What does that tell you about me? It tells you that I am determined, that I am disciplined, and that I have a tolerance for pain. Politics is not a pain-free exercise, and being able to take it is a good thing. I'm a religion professor. Now, look around the world, whether it's in our domestic sphere or globally, and tell me, look me in the eye and tell me that religion does not matter in domestic policy or in foreign policy. I think we need more people who have that kind of training in our government, not less. I'm also a veteran. I'm the one person on the stage who knows what foreign policy feels like, who has had to pick up a phone and have my commanding officer on the other end saying, John, your name is on the mobilization list. And then having to turn to my wife, who was 6 months pregnant, and my two-year-old daughter, and tell them that Daddy was going away and we weren't quite sure when he was coming back again. That experience, as well as the lived bipartisanship of military service, is, I think, a great foundation for running in the 13th District.
Thank you all for that, those answers. As you might expect, some of the questions overlap. There are several on what is perhaps one of the most defining issues for Democrats in the last 9 to 20 years, health care. Christopher Myers of Bloomington asks a simple yes or no, oh, if it were only so simple. Do you believe that all Americans have a right to health care? And Mr. Jones, we'll start with you this time.
Well, that's a good question, and I have a simple answer to that, which the answer is yes. And the question then becomes, how do we achieve that? So I've been saying throughout this campaign that I believe that health care is a human right and that we need to be achieving universal coverage in this country as soon as possible. And I'm not new to this fight. I will tell you in my background, when I was a congressional investigator, I took on health insurance companies during the fight for the ACA. And we uncovered that insurance companies were spending up to 40% of the premium dollars that they'd received from their policyholders on things unrelated to healthcare. They were spending on CEO pay. They were spending on advertising and marketing. And so we took them to task on that. We put out a report, and we made some progress on it. So now insurance companies have to spend more on patient care instead of on these other things. But the problem is that's not enough. The steps that we took on the ACA were half steps, and we have to go the whole way. And to do that, we have to, and this is what I've been proposing, we have to open up the Medicare system so that anybody in this country has access to health care. And we can do it allowing people to either opt in or to buy into Medicare so that everyone has it and it's affordable. I'll tell you, I've gone throughout this district. I've heard too many stories of too many families being affected by health care catastrophes that happened to them. We can't stop emergencies from occurring to us. We cannot stop from getting sick, but we can make sure that there's not a catastrophe on the back end once you're trying to recover or you're trying to get the services you need. And health care is too expensive in this country. We need to take on the pharmaceutical companies, and we need to take on the healthcare companies so we have the government involved. Thank you.
Ms. Sides, you're up. Right or privilege for healthcare?
I think it's a right. I would support H.R. 676. It's already a bill out there that, as I campaign, I'm asking people to call their congressmen to co-sponsor and ask them to co-sponsor H.R. 676. But it covers everyone, guaranteed coverage. Would save the average family of four $4,000 a month when you consider the high cost of insurance premiums. And I think that it also covers, a lot of people say, well, this is socialism, and I just want to point out we already have socialism in this country, like the libraries, our fire departments, our schools, and our Social Security. So I think first and foremost, if anything is socialized, it should be our health care. And so it covers drug rehabilitation and home care for the elderly. And it is something that I'm passionate about. I held a town hall to have a referendum to put it on the ballot to be passed just for the state of Illinois. But I just feel that people don't need to be stressed out when they're sick, and the elderly need a simple solution for health care. When you're stressed out, it actually affects your health. And so first and foremost, people don't need to worry about medical bills when they're sick.
There's time on that one. Thank you very much. Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan, you're up.
That's a resounding yes. I believe that health care is a right and not a privilege. And right now, what we can do is we can achieve universal health care coverage. The first step to doing that is by stabilizing the ACA and making sure that we stop the bleeding that's happening right now. The Republicans are doing everything they can to chip away at health care because they couldn't repeal it, because people stood up and said no. We have to continue to do that, and we have to have people in the room at the decision-making tables who are going to try to stabilize it and then move forward. When we move forward, we can incorporate a public option. There are great plans out there right now, whether it's a Medicare X or Medicaid for All. There's great plans out there. We have to have the right people at the decision-making tables. We can right now unshackle Medicare to bargain for prescription drug prices. These are things that we can do now to make sure that we have quality, affordable health care accessible to everyone. The number one impediment right now to our health care is congressmen like Rodney Davis.
And Mr. Ebel.
I do believe that health care is a universal human right, and I support expanded, improved Medicare for All. I come to this position from a moral perspective and through a series of questions that I ask myself, which is, what is the right number of babies that can't see a doctor? What's the right number of families bankrupted by a chronic illness? What's the right number of hospitals that go under because they're not being paid for the services they provide? For me, that number is zero. And if you want to hold on to the ACA and perform a little bit of triage, your number is significantly higher than zero. In fact, it's in 30 million or so. This was a good step in the right direction. It was a good idea to try to expand healthcare, but it hasn't gone nearly far enough. And those people who are outside of that umbrella are waiting, and they are at risk at any moment of losing their everything they've earned, losing their livelihood because of an illness. This is something that is part of who we are as people. We are all going to be sick at some point. We are all going to need a doctor. There is no reason why we can't institute on a nationwide basis a system that covers everyone, that makes it so that everyone who needs care can get that care. To me, that is a moral calling for all of us, and it's the moral issue of our time.
And Dr. Gill.
I know a lot about health care. I've been a doctor for 30 years. For 25 years, I've been a member of a group called Physicians for a National Health Program. Oh, and the answer to your question, Christopher, is yes. Immediately, healthcare should be a right and not a privilege. I joined PNHP 25 years ago. They are the group of 20,000 doctors that have been pushing for single-payer healthcare in this country for decades. They wrote H.R. 676, the single-payer bill that currently is in the House. I spent time as the assistant director of the Illinois Department of Public Health back at a pivotal time when we were developing and implementing the rollout of the ACA here in Illinois. And we need single-payer health care now, not tomorrow. Because every day that goes by that we leave the for-profit private health insurance industry running the show is another day that an American citizen dies every 15 minutes just because they don't have the right kind of insurance. 100 Americans dead every day for that reason. And on the flip side, we've got a system run by the for-profit private health insurance industry with individuals like William McGuire. He was the CEO of United Healthcare, retired a few years ago, and was given a retirement bonus of $1.6 billion with a B dollars. So do the arithmetic. William McGuire gets $100,000 a day every day to spend on himself for 42 years, 100 grand a day. And on each of those days, 100 Americans die because they don't have the right kind of insurance. We can do so much better, and we will.
Thank you, soon. Dr. Gill. You're all crystal clarion clear about that last question. Regardless of your beliefs, though, it is also clear that our country currently has no shared vision for health care. Even the Affordable Care Act was a bridge too far for many Americans. Do you believe that such a unified policy or vision is an important predicate to addressing health system deficiencies? And if so, Larissa Armstrong of Bloomington and Lori Walrab of Normal both want to know how you would go about developing one. And let's start with Angel Sides.
Well, I mean, I think we do have the funds to go to a single-payer system.
Let me redirect you. That was a political question. How do you develop a shared vision among
Well, I think
everyone.
A lot of people consider it socialized medicine. It would take a lot of education. A lot of people think we can't afford it, and we can. And I would just share, you know, that information because, you know, when we subsidize industry so highly and we a lot of our tax dollars go to war and things like bailing out the banks. If we can do all that, we're the richest country in the world. We can afford health care. Every industrialized country in the world has some form of universal health care, except the United States. So you have to ask yourself, how are we different than them when we're the richest country in the world and we don't have it? So, I mean, it would take a lot of education and just bombarding people with the facts that, you know, it would help our economy and we need to end these perpetual wars where 64% of our discretionary spending goes to war. And I think, you know, just educating the public like that. Because, you know, as I'm doing a commentary on independent media and how corrupted our media is, and we really do have corporate censored media, and people don't realize it, and that's the kind of thing that gives people that attitude with the rhetoric and
thank
propaganda.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so it takes some education.
Ms. Dirksen, Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, is a shared vision on healthcare policy necessary? And if so, how do we get there?
It is. One of my favorite ladies, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, has a quote that I love. Fight for the things that you believe in, but lead so others will want to follow you. And I think with the health care, with moving our health care forward, in order to create a unified vision, we have to meet people where they're at right now. Right now, we have a lot of people who do benefit from the ACA. We have a lot of people who like their employer-provided health insurance. We have a lot of labor unions who have made huge investments to make sure that their members have fantastic health care. We have senior citizens who love Medicare. We have all of these plans out there right now. So let's introduce another option to cover people who don't fall into those categories. That's why I believe that universal health care coverage is the first step. Let's get everybody covered and get access to quality, affordable health care for everyone. And let's work together on creating that unified vision of how we continue to move forward.
Jonathan Abel.
I'm not sure. If we need a shared vision to implement any policy in the United States, we're really not going to get much done. I am a historian of the United States, and I know that from the very beginning, whether it's the colonial period or anywhere forward, there's always been division. And what we have lost, it seems to me, is a desire or an ability to reach some sort of compromise. So a couple of things. I believe that we could do a better job as progressive Democrats arguing for the financial benefits of Medicare for All. People oftentimes point to the expense without acknowledging that we are already in a very expensive and inefficient system, and that by most measures, Medicare for All would reduce those costs and deliver a better product. And I think that Americans are always open to that line of argument. I think, too, and one of the reasons that I approach this from a moral perspective is that we as a people respond positively to calls for to help our fellow Americans, to acknowledge how knit together we are as a people. So that would be another way in which we can work toward that shared vision. It is not going to be easy, but I think it is morally urgent for us to acknowledge those who are outside of the current healthcare system, who are not being cared for, and to find a way to bring everyone in under that umbrella.
David Gill, shared visions and ways to get there.
I agree with John. I don't think a shared vision is entirely necessary. You're not going to have 100% of the American public on board with an improved Medicare for all or single-payer healthcare system. William McGuire, the retired CEO of UnitedHealthcare, he's not going to like the type of program that I'm talking about. But to a certain extent, a shared vision is necessary. And to a large extent, it's already present among the voting public. As a member of PNHP, I've been following this for a quarter century. When I started there, 20% of the public wanted single-payer. Now 60% does. 60% of doctors want a single-payer healthcare system in this country. Who doesn't want it are the William McGuires and the members of Congress who take all those large checks from the pharmaceutical industry and the health insurance industry. People want it. People are demanding it. They need to elect different people. And I think that they have an opportunity here in Illinois 13 to elect not just a congressperson, but a game changer. Because we've been talking about single payer for decades. FDR put it in his second Bill of Rights that unfortunately didn't get passed. Republican Richard Nixon was talking about single payer in 1970. But decade after decade goes by, and we keep having an American die every 15 minutes because we don't get this passed. Send a doctor to Washington who can tell the horror stories, who has lived the horror stories, and who can address the myths that are out there. And I think that I can take the position of a leader in moving this country toward the single-payer healthcare system that is desperately needed.
Eric Jones, your take on the question.
Thank you. So I've been involved in these processes before, trying to create compromise or create bills to get enough consensus together so you can get a bill through either the legislature in Springfield or in Washington. I've done that over and over again. And I will tell you, at some point, you do need a consensus to get something through. And we will have to fight for that. Now, is that going to mean everyone is going to be together on something? Absolutely not. But the way we're going to do this, one is I actually believe that if you talk to anybody in this country, everyone agrees that we have problems with our healthcare system right now. Whether it's because somebody doesn't have access to it at all, or it's because they're a small business owner and their premiums are costing them $25,000 a year. I've talked to a lot of people in this situation. And while Obamacare or ACA made steps in the right direction, one thing that did not get done, and this was because of an effort by special interests and the insurance companies, was anything to do on cost control. And I do believe that there is an interest in cost control and expansion of access in this country, and I think there is a consensus to get this done. But we have to get the right people in Washington who are willing to fight for it and who understand how to build a record. And what we're going to have to do is get to Congress and put together hearings and do investigations to show what people are paying and how much is coming out of their pocket and show them what we can do to fix that. And there are plenty of options out there to do that, and I actually believe that when we get a new president and we get a new Congress, we will get this done. There is a lot of agreement among both Republicans and Democrats on going after the pharmaceutical companies to ensure that our pharmaceutical prices go down. We need to allow Medicare and the government to be negotiating there, and there are options there I think we can achieve.
Thank you all. I'm going to ask a follow-up question. Everyone's going to get 30 seconds, and we're going to go in the same order. So Angel Sides will start, and the question deals with the point that Eric Jones just raised about cost control. What steps would you take to address the fragmentation in healthcare, to promote continuity and coordination of care and access to the continuum of quality care that drives cost control? Prevention, mental and oral health services, all that coordination can drive cost control. How would you get to a lower overall cost?
H.R. 676 actually phases out the insurance companies while it retrains the workers. So I think, you know, a lot of what is being said about it is nurses take over a larger role. So I think we have the money. It's just where our taxes are being diverted. They're not being diverted back to the American people. We have to end the big tax breaks for the rich, end the tax loopholes, and end all these perpetual wars that we are constantly fighting.
Thank you very much. Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan?
Well, in addition to bringing down the pharmaceutical costs, right now Medicare has instituted programs called shared savings programs. And it really encourages a different set of practices that promotes value over volume. And they have 4 years of data, they're seeing great results in bringing down the costs of service and increasing the care that people are receiving. If we can expand on some of the successes that Medicare has right now, then we can bring costs down, especially if Medicaid adopts it.
Jonathan Ebel. So there
are two things that I would try to do. First of all, we need to engage in a nationwide education program that transitions us from what we have now, a sick care system, into a health care system, so that people are being trained into wellness from a very early age with exercise and diet, and lowering the bar of access to seeing a physician. That's thing number two. Right now, our healthcare industry and health insurance companies are making their money by de-incentivizing people from seeing doctors, which de-incentivizes early intervention, which raises costs over the long term.
David Gill.
Cost control is easy when it comes to single payer because you'll finally have a system in place. The biggest part of the problem currently, Charlie, is that we don't have a healthcare system. We have this crazy amalgam of 1,500 different insurance companies, millions of different healthcare providers. And when you have a system in place, you can design that system to be as efficient and as good as you want it to be. You can engage in cost controls if necessary. I don't know that they'll be especially necessary. It's today that we throw $1 trillion away for nothing to the for-profit private health insurance industry and waste so much money not negotiating on drug prices.
And Eric Jones, you're the last bite at this particular apple.
Okay, 30 seconds. I'll go really fast. The health insurance companies, they make money because they get a slice of the larger pie. The problem is they have no interest. There's no market mechanism having them create a smaller pie. It's always growing, and they're going to continue to try to take a larger piece of it. We need to get the government involved so that there is it's competition, so people can choose if they want to go into a Medicare-based system. That will create cost controls, which will create everything else to go down. But we also can't ignore other aspects of the healthcare system that are inefficient. We need to be doing better on electronic records, and I had more to say, but we're stopping.
Thanks for choosing GLT and Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to a special broadcast of a 13th District Democratic Candidate Forum for Congress, co-sponsored with the McLean County League of Women Voters. We're coming to you from the Normal Theater in Uptown. What measures do you favor to reduce and eventually zero out the federal deficit? Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan, you're up first this time.
That's a big question. The bill that was just passed by the Republicans and signed by Trump is not the way to do it.
The tax bill?
The tax bill. And creating, $1.41 trillion debt by 2027, going the exact wrong direction. And none of that money is allocated for infrastructure right now. In order for us to move our country forward, we have to make investments in infrastructure, not just roads and bridges, but also waterways, pipelines, electrical grids. Those investments pay us back time over and over again. It helps our rural communities, it provides jobs, and it strengthens our local economies. I think a way that in addition to cutting some of the costs that we have in some of our federal programs, we can move to, instead of focusing on pay and chase model where we have to go after people for paying bills, we can focus on making sure that we're addressing waste and error in the front side. There are programs to do that effectively. But we also have to make sure that the money that we are spending is coming back to us and is not just going to help corporations and the wealthiest 1%. It's got to come back and help the middle class and help our local economies grow.
Jonathan Ebel.
So I can tell you what I wouldn't do, which is slash Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. And I can tell you that that's what's on Paul Ryan's agenda. And if it's on Paul Ryan's agenda, it's on Rodney Davis's agenda as well. This tax reform bill, as Betsy just pointed out, is a disaster. And it is going to add $1.5 trillion to that deficit. So I think that there is an opportunity here to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat for our entire nation, not just for the Democratic Party, but for our entire nation. This will be a ruinous bill if it is allowed to stand as it passed. My suggestion is that we actually enforce a 22% corporate tax rate. Now, that rate was cut, remember, from 35 or 34% down to 22%. The dirty secret is that corporations were never paying 35%. If you're AT&T, you were paying between 8 and 12%. So, hey, let's live by the letter of that law. Let's close the corporate loopholes in the tax reform bill, and let's make them pay the 22%. Let's also reinstate the estate tax, and finally close the carried interest loophole so that those who are making money on trades while they're sitting back are being taxed at the same rate that those who are working in McDonald's or building our roads are being taxed as well. I think we can generate plenty of revenue by those moves to begin to move our budget to a neutral place.
David Gill, deficit reduction.
Well, I've been saying for a long time, Charlie, that it's time for the millionaires and billionaires in this country to pay their fair share. That would go a long way toward helping with the deficit. As the other candidates have indicated, the recent tax reform passage was a travesty when it comes to moving in that proper direction. As John indicates, the corporate America, they've actually been paying 18%, and almost half of the large corporations have been paying a grand total of zero in taxes. And the reason that they've been paying such low rates is because of the thousands of loopholes that are contained within the tax code put there by lobbyists who funnel money into your congresspeople. And so an indirect step toward helping with our deficit would be campaign finance reform. I also believe there's numerous steps to help with the deficit. We need to stop the endless warfare that we engage in, the bloated military budget that is the sum of the next 8 to 27 countries, depending on who's doing the counting and how you're counting. We need to stop the privatizing of prisons, and we need to stop locking people up for nonviolent offenses. It's one of the reasons that I support the legalization of recreational marijuana. And you grow your economy and ultimately reduce your deficit by investing in people. And that's one of the reasons I support a $15 an hour minimum wage now. Good for everybody, especially good for the servers in this country who are really damaged by having a $2.13 per hour minimum wage. And another way you invest in your people is by having the green revolution that we so desperately need to ultimately save our species.
Eric Jones.
If you go to Representative Davis's website right now and you click on his views on the deficit, he will say, you'll see that it says that it's a crisis we quote unquote cannot ignore any longer. I looked up ignore in the dictionary just to double check, and it turns out that adding over $1 trillion to the deficit is the opposite. We have to do something about those issues immediately. The fact that they did a corporate tax cut and a tax cut for the super wealthy, and they've got nothing for it, there's nothing that's going to end up in American jobs, I think is a travesty. And that's number one. No more tax cuts for the super rich and corporations. Two, we need to stop something called inversion, which is this notion where corporations are reconstituting themselves in other countries so they can evade American tax law. We've got to put a stop to the loopholes that all the corporations and others have referenced this and the super wealthy are using so that you and I are paying a higher tax rate than a lot of the wealthiest people in this country. And that's unacceptable. And then finally, I would say there is something we need to do on waste, fraud, and abuse in our government. That is something that is a problem. And it's something I've worked on before. As a congressional investigator for the House Oversight Committee, part of my job was uncovering places where the federal government was wasting money. And I'll tell you, that does happen, and we can't ignore that. And as a member of Congress, I would work on those issues to ensure that we are spending our resources as efficiently as possible. And the problem that we've faced is a lot of the Republicans are trying to cut the very institutions, whether it's Inspectors General or the Department of Justice, that are actually working on these issues. And that's another way to save money.
And Angel Sides.
Yeah, I think the tax plan, the new tax plan, is going to put us have America have even a higher deficit. We need to end the loopholes, and when we have the wealthiest 0.01% of the wealthiest families in this country own as much wealth as the bottom 90%, and they don't pay their fair share of taxes, and they use these loopholes and they get out of paying taxes, that is our taxes. I mean, they own so much of the wealth. So we need to raise the corporate tax rate and end all these perpetual wars where 64% of our discretionary spending goes. We need to stop highly subsidizing industry to the tune of billions of dollars a year, and we really need to raise the minimum wage, I think, would help. It's proven to help in communities and help the economy. We're the cities that have passed a raise in the minimum wage. But I really feel like we need to rein in these corporations. When five men own as much wealth as the bottom half of the planet, to operate in the state they originated from, and that would open up a lot more mom-and-pop operations. I think that would help the economy immensely.
Thank you all for that response. I'm going to ask a follow-up on this, so we'll go in the same order, and 30 seconds for it. Dr. Gill was the only one who mentioned military spending, which is a popular thing for Democrats to mention. But none of you mentioned what Republicans claim is a key driver in the deficit, and that's entitlement reform. They claim it's the largest portion of the deficit. You may disagree with that, but certainly you're going to have to address changes in the entitlement structure to get to zero on a deficit, and I'd like you to address that. And we'll start with Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan.
Sure. Well, there are a couple things that we can do to increase funds. We can raise the Social Security cap. We also, in the tax bill, they just got rid of the corporate alternative minimum tax. We can put that back in. In terms of the federal programs, Medicare is transforming right now. They are bringing their costs down through these shared savings programs and through these accountable care organizations. Let's look at programs that work in reining in our federal spending, like these programs in place now. Let's bring in Medicaid into that mix, and let's see what we can do. We cannot cut Medicare and Medicaid or Social Security, no.
Jonathan Ebel.
I guess I disagree with the premise of the question, which is that a zeroed out deficit is the goal that we should be striving for. I like a balanced checkbook like anybody, but I also believe that we as a nation have a responsibility to each other to maintain a robust safety net, social safety net. And right now, Medicare, Medicaid, SNAP benefits, Social Security are holding people up who desperately need that. So if we're looking to reform our budget, those are not places that I would look.
David Gill.
You know, I disagree with the use of the term entitlements, Charlie. Those are not entitlements. Those are things that people have earned. When you look at your paycheck that you get every week or two or month, people have put money into that anticipating that they're funding their future health care or their future retirement. And so if there's any changing to be done, I think it's in preserving and strengthening those programs, not privatizing them, not raising retirement age.
Eric Jones.
I agree. I was going to say the same thing on entitlement. I think that's the wrong word to be using. I think it implies that this is something people are just being given, and it's not. Social Security is something that we're all putting into and we're all earning as we speak. You know, I think the problem that we're facing here is that the Republican Party has put forward a $1 trillion tax cut. And they've done it before, and they've just done it again, and they're going to use it as an excuse to try to cut back Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and we have to fight against it. And, you know, in the Bush administration, we went to a war with Iraq right after a tax cut and spent $1 trillion there, and I think we can be using our money better.
And Angel Sides.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know really what to say for that either. I'm sure there are some places to save money, but I just think it's propaganda, and even the term entitlement reform, that's not the way to balance the budget.
This is Sound Ideas. You're listening to a Congressional Candidates Forum for the Democratic Party in the 13th Congressional District at the Normal Theater in Uptown. Catherine Tang of Collinsville asks, what specific action do the candidates intend to take in order to address the terrible phenomenon of mass shootings? And we start with Mr. Ebel.
Yes. So on the issue of gun violence prevention, I teach at the University of Illinois, as I mentioned, and a good size class at the U of I is 90 students. We lose 90 Americans every day, an entire classroom of students at the U of I, to gun violence. Two-thirds of those, about 60, are self-inflicted gunshot wounds or suicides. So The mass shootings are obviously an important thing. They're horrible when they happen, but they are a part of a much larger culture of violence that we need to address as a public health crisis, and that I think will give itself up to a couple of kinds of solutions. On the mass shootings, as the questioner asked, I think we need to institute background checks for mandatory background checks for weapons purchases and ammunitions purchases, and do everything we can to keep firearms out of the hands of those with a history of mental health problems, domestic abuse, and, as it turns out, animal abuse as well. I think, too, that I'll turn, actually I have 30 seconds, I'll turn to the question of suicide. We do need to do a far better job of educating people about the really dangerous intersection of mental health problems or chronic clinical depression and the presence of guns in a home. That is the leading cause of gun violence death in America, and it is something that is through education and through letting people know that although the Second Amendment is the law of the land, it does not have to be the law of your household. That if someone is suffering from clinical depression, you should take the gun away.
Thank you very much. Dr. Gill.
I appreciate the question. Working in the emergency department, gun violence is something that touches me at a very personal level. I see far too many victims on a far too regular basis, and it leaves me passionate with regards to instituting some reforms so that we don't see these types of mass shootings or less than mass shootings, you know, simple things that 80 to 90% of the American public agrees on, but that we don't see because of the dominance of the NRA special interest getting money into the pockets of our congresspeople. Things like mandatory background checks on every gun purchased and limiting the number of rounds per magazine to 10 or less. That's the only issue that you'll ever hear me agreeing with Dick Cheney on. And the banning of the bump stocks that we saw featured in that Las Vegas massacre. I thought that surely here was a time where Congress could find the bravery in their hearts to stand up and do something shortly after that Las Vegas incident. But no, the NRA is that powerful. And I think what Professor Ebel says is very important. I also spend upwards of a quarter of my day in the ER dealing with mental health situations. And the way that our current healthcare system deals with mental health devalues people, dehumanizes them, demonizes people that have mental health issues. And when we have a single-payer healthcare system, we'll be able to treat mental health in the same vigorous way in which we do physical health and do much better with regards to that.
Eric Jones, your turn.
I think there are steps that we could be taking as a country immediately that most Americans agree on to stem the problem with gun violence in this country. First off, everyone should get a background check before they buy a gun. And right now, as it stands, criminals, domestic terrorists, people who've been convicted of domestic abuse can go out and buy a gun in this country, and that is unacceptable. We also still allow bump stocks to be purchased, even though we saw what happened following the Las Vegas shooting. And then finally, even though we've seen mass shootings over and over and over again, what has Congress been working on? They've been working on a reciprocity bill. For those of you who don't know what that is, they want to allow anybody who has a concealed carry license in anywhere in the country, it should apply in any state, which would take away Illinois' right to determine how Illinois has its concealed carry law. And that's unacceptable. And on every one of these issues, the reason why that's the bill they're pushing in reciprocity, or the reason why they haven't banned bump stocks, or the reason why they haven't done a background check is because of the gun lobby in Washington. And that's the challenge that we're facing over and over and over again on all these issues, whether it's on climate change or whether it's on health care reform or whether it's on getting a tax system that's actually fair to the middle class and not doing favors for the super rich. It's a special interest in Washington that we're fighting against. That's what I've been fighting throughout my career, and that's what I'm going to go to Washington to do.
And Angel Sides, your take on this.
Yeah, doing my political commentary and editing and splicing and dicing different excerpts of documentaries, there seems to be a lot of information out there that has a link between psychotropic drugs, painkillers, and some of these mass shootings. If you look at the people who actually were engaged in these mass shootings. So I think we really need to, it kind of goes back to campaign finance reform, because Big Pharma is the biggest lobbyist of Congress, and supposedly Eli Lilly knew that they were putting a drug on the market that caused violence, and they're doing this just for the fact that even though they're going to be sued, they factor that in, they can still make a lot more money putting a dangerous drug on the market. So that should be discussed along with the gun issue when we have all these mass shootings. I think we need a voluntary trade-in of semi-automatic weapons for maybe half the cost of what the gun is worth, and we need to end privatized sales of guns.
And Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan.
Thank you. I agree with my colleagues that we need universal, unified federal background checks. And I am against the concealed carry reciprocity. We have very specific laws in Illinois about who can and can't carry a concealed weapon. And what this does is we require in Illinois for anybody to carry a concealed weapon, they have to have 16 hours of actual live training. That's what we've determined. This law takes that away from us, and it says the people from Wisconsin, Indiana, Iowa, who don't have to have any training in live fire training, if they have a concealed carry license, they can bring their gun into our state. I disagree with that. I would also like to see us, in order to address these mass shootings and the gun violence in our communities, we need to have the Center for Disease Control do what it, at one time it was allowed to do and then has been disallowed to do by the United States government, and that is to study gun violence as the public health crisis that it is. Drill down on the root causes and give us some actionable steps to cure this disease of gun violence in our communities.
You're listening to Special Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's public media, a Democratic congressional candidate forum for the 13th District at the Normal Theater. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Our candidates are Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, Jonathan Ebel, David Gill, Eric Jones, and Angel Sides. There has been a deadlock in Congress for many years now on infrastructure renewal. Part of the deadlock has been the inability to come up with a funding mix, whether that is a gas tax increase, a tax on miles driven, allocation for other revenue sources, or whatnot. What is your sweet spot for a funding mix you believe will get bipartisan buy-in for an infrastructure bill? And let us start with David Gill.
The need for infrastructure reform in this country is urgent, and we see it right here in Illinois 13 with deteriorating bridges and roadways, the lack of broadband access in large parts of this congressional district, and it extends nationwide as well, the need. And the funding is there. I say all the time that when we talk about a wide variety of issues in campaigns such as this, that it's a question of reordering our priorities. You know, why we insist on engaging in endless warfare. I was out there, probably a lot of the people in this auditorium were out there in very early 2003 saying, don't invade Iraq. And we lost the people that argued against it. We went in there. And the money that we wasted, the trillions of dollars because of that invasion and the consequences of that invasion, could have been used to pay for infrastructure repair many times over. Could have been used for 50 to 100 years of free college for everybody that wanted to go to college. And so the resources are there, Charlie. If we stop engaging in endless war and pandering to the arms manufacturers and the oil industry, and instead turn to things like Green Revolution that I was mentioning before, there are so many jobs to be had in putting solar panels on all of the roofs here in Illinois 13. Again, when we have our priorities in order, when we have representatives that are not funded by corporate America, we'll do the right thing.
Eric Jones.
I agree that it is a matter of priority. We are the wealthiest country in the world, and if we want to invest in infrastructure in this country, we have the resources to do it, and we just need to do it. And I think sometimes we forget that we've done big things in this country before. In the 1930s, half of this country did not have electricity. We had a rural electrification problem. The Roosevelt administration stepped forward, created the REA and the electric co-op system, and now we take for granted that everyone in this country has access to electricity. In the 1950s, we started the interstate system under President Eisenhower, a Republican, and invested heavily in that interstate system, which has been a big driver of the economy that we now have. And what we're facing right now is we have roads that are falling apart, we have bridges that are becoming more dangerous, and we have too many people in this country who do not have access to basic high-speed internet. You know, I pulled the numbers from the Federal Communications Commission, and in the 13th District alone, in the counties that make up the district, over 200,000 people do not have access to basic high-speed internet. And when I say don't have access, I mean they can't get it if they want it. And a lot of them don't have access to cell phone service where they live either. And I speak from this from personal perspective. My in-laws live in Wayne County, Illinois, in Fairfield, and they live just right outside of town. And when I would go work there, they have no access to the internet. And so when I would work, I would have to go sit either in the lobby of McDonald's or sometimes in the parking lot to get access to their Wi-Fi. And there are too many people in this country that are doing that. There are students that are doing that. And in order for us to have an economy that's working in every zip code, we have to invest in our infrastructure, and that means rural broadband.
Angel Sides.
Yeah, I think a good way to save money on our infrastructure and even make money for any given city would be solar roads. I've been in contact with Scott and Julie Broussard, and they have roads that actually melt the snow, which would save money in the long term with, you know, like plowing snow or putting salt on the roads. They supply a city with three times the electricity it needs if every road, sidewalk, and parking lot were paved. Therefore, eventually, houses could be electrically heated. They're kind of neat. They tuck electrical lines under the road so they're more accessible. They detect animals on the road, and so that could save lives in the long run. And you can change the pattern of, let's say, a parking lot after hours from a parking lot to maybe a basketball court, and kids can play basketball or hopscotch. So they're computers, and there's panels that if something were to break could be taken up and just replace a panel instead of having to continually repave or replace the road itself. So I think roads need to be replaced anyway or need to be repaved, they should be replaced with solar roads, and the same with federal buildings like rooftops, they could be replaced with solar roofs and have solar panels. And
Thank you very much. Betsy Dirksen Londrigan, infrastructure and unlocking the deadlock on it.
You know, we have to look at it differently than we're looking at what they just did with the tax bill and creating a larger deficit. We can't look at it like that's just the deficit, just that's money that's going to corporations and the wealthiest 1%. Infrastructure, on the other hand, is an investment that we are making in ourselves and in our local communities. Whether it's modernizing our roads and bridges, or it is fixing the leaky pipes that are leaching mercury and arsenic into waterways, or it's improving our waterway system so our Illinois farmers can move their product along the river, or it's improving the electrical grid and making sure that people in every part of the district are able to turn their lights on and save money at the same time. This is an investment we are making in ourselves. It will create jobs, and when it creates the jobs, the money goes right back into our local communities. That means more local businesses. It means more disposable income for restaurants and for Main Street. That's what we want. So we have to look at it with a different perspective. We have to look at it as an investment in our future. And in terms of rural broadband, we have to connect our rural communities. I was visiting with business owners in Elsa, Illinois, who have beautiful forests and bald eagle sightings and are struggling to get people to their beds and breakfast because they can't get the word out because they are on dial-up or their cell phones don't work. We can fix that with an investment in ourselves.
And Jonathan Ebel.
Yeah. So in early 2003, that's actually when that phone call came from my commanding officer with my mobilization orders. And I bring that up now because I think that where we are failing as a country has something to do with priorities, but it also has something to do with bipartisan cooperation. There's nobody who loves a pothole, right? Nobody who just looks for that moment of intermittent cell phone service and cherishes it when it happens. We agree on the need for good infrastructure. We aren't able to get it done because of the amount of bipartisan mistrust in Congress and the way in which that has been cultivated. So I was happy last month to receive the endorsement of a group called With Honor. It is a group of veterans who are supporting veterans running for Congress. And the idea is that by getting people into Congress who have the shared experience, the shared lived bipartisanship of military service, you're providing some sort of foundation for cooperation and for a functional Congress going forward. I would love to be a part of a veterans caucus that is out making that argument that we need to make this investment in infrastructure from broadband to sidewalks because it benefits all of us, and we on both sides of the aisle can agree on that.
You all very nobly talked about the need for infrastructure and the various ways in which it might happen and the kinds of infrastructure that are needed. But the sense of the question was about a funding mix that will prove bipartisan, that will have some bipartisan attraction, whether that's a gas tax increase for the first time in a long time or miles driven or some other form of revenue. And to it's not just an investment on the Republican side, so you're going to have to address what Republicans might like and sign on to in this follow-up question, which will be 30 seconds. And let's take it from the top again with David Gill starting about funding and what might prove saleable in Congress.
Well, I think that ultimately if Republican representatives will respond to ordinary people that would like to see a single-payer healthcare system in place, immediately you save $1 trillion, Charlie, and I don't know what your cost estimate is for the infrastructure repair that you're talking about, but I think that gives you a great big head start toward being able to put in place the types of repairs that we've been talking about for the last several minutes.
Eric Jones?
Well, I guess I would just take a point with the premise of the question, which is I'm running for Congress to replace a Republican who I don't think believes is doing the right thing on infrastructure. And I think what we need is a Congress that's composed of Democrats and Republicans who believe in infrastructure spending. And I will tell you, if you look at what Donald Trump did in 2016, Donald Trump ran on investment in infrastructure. That's all he talked about, other than, well, there's some other things too, but he talked a lot about that. And what has he done on it? Nothing. So I actually think the American people do want an investment in infrastructure, and I think they're ready to do it in the normal way we've been funding the government for years.
Angel Sides, how to pay for it.
Well, I mean, I kind of just said, like, the solar roads, I think, I mean, it just seems like we're stuck in, you know, this fossil fuel administration and the Secretary of State's an oil man, but you would think if, you know, the funding would save, you know, every city, every community money, because in the long run, you're not having to replace roads all the time. You're not really having to plow the roads, and it actually provides every city with three times the electricity it needs, and that's money too. So they definitely pay for themselves.
Alrighty, thank you, Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan.
I agree. We need to change the representation. We have to change the people in the room who are making the decisions. Part of that should be revisiting the tax bill. And it means putting the corporate alternative minimum tax back in place. Because all it did was pull the floor out from corporations. So it's a race to the bottom, and we took the floor out so it can just keep going. There is a minimum tax that corporations should have to pay for the privilege of business in the United States.
Jonathan Ebel?
Currently, earned income is taxed at roughly twice the rate of unearned income, the income that people make sitting back in their big comfy chairs watching their stock portfolios grow. Let's tax unearned income at the same rate as earned income, and we will be able to pay for roads and sidewalks and bridges and airports and broadband and everything else that everybody wants from now and into the future.
All righty. Thank you all very much for that, those answers to the follow-up.
There are many permutations of a possible way forward for deferred action for childhood arrivals or DACA recipients. Clean DACA, DACA and WAL funding linked, the McCain-Coons bill, which looks at DACA and a broader border security strategy, but not a WAL in particular. Those are just a few. Where do you gauge the compromise is most ripe to happen between Democrats, the Trump administration, and congressional Republicans who can support a way forward on this issue? And let's start with Mr. Jones.
Well, first I'll say, let me be clear on where I stand on this issue of the Dreamers or DACA or DACA. The United States government made a promise to these people, to the children and the who came forward and said, I'm going to let you know who I am and we're going to work together because the United States government made a promise. And now that promise is being used against them. They stepped forward, and now the United States government has fallen back on the promise that they would allow the path to citizenship over time. We have to get this done. It's a moral imperative, and I think we have to work on how that's going to get done. You know, I saw that there was a recent government shutdown over it. There was then a three-week spending bill. I think the Democrats need to hold strong on this issue and need to continue pushing this and so we can get the Dreamers to have the rights that they were promised. I'm very concerned, frankly, I'll tell you. It appears that Donald Trump isn't interested in getting this done, and it appears the Republicans in the House are not interested in getting this done. The good news is the Senate Democrats have a role to play here, and I'm very hopeful that eventually there will be a compromise that comes forward. And we still have just a little bit of time. The sort of deadline that's really going to matter is in March, and I'm very hopeful that something will get done before then, but I have been concerned about it.
Angel Sides.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like nothing will get done with this either. But what people don't know is the DACA recipients, they don't really use any federal money. They don't have any handouts. They don't even qualify for a student loan. But another thing that, as far as illegal immigrants are concerned, there are these detention centers all over the country. And some of the women are raped and the men are beaten, and they're in places where people don't even know where these detention centers are, like Geo Group. And to save money, they don't offer health care or enough food. And, you know, I think that's more of a matter of torture. And I think, you know, as far as the immigrancy issue, that's something a lot of people don't know about. And that's just something I just want to throw in there that's got to stop, these for-profit detention centers.
Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan.
Right out of the gate, I want to say that I want to codify DACA and protect Dreamers. And I have so much admiration for our senators here in Illinois who have stood so strong against Donald Trump. And we need more people like them in Congress. You know, I was in Springfield at an event, and the event was primarily immigrants, and I was having a fantastic conversation with a couple. He was a CPA and she's a neonatologist. And after a few minutes, I said to them, well, where did you immigrate from? Haiti. And this was the day after Senator Dick Durbin stood up to Donald Trump. And I said, I'm so sorry you had to hear that from our president. And they said, well, thank you for saying that. We know that there's good people like you, like Senator Durbin, who are going to fight for us. And we can't lose sight of that, of changing the people who are in the room at the decision-making tables. That is on us to do. I want our immigrants to have a clear path to citizenship. I want our Democrats to hold strong. I believe immigrants have made this beautiful mosaic of our nation, and I will stand up for them and for all of us.
And Professor Ebel, your shot at this.
So I have to say that I was a little bit disappointed in the leadership of the Democratic Party a few weeks ago, and the standing strong didn't quite come through when we had the government shut down, and we had the Republicans in a place where they were going to be forced to negotiate feels to me like we abandoned an opportunity there to get this resolution done for DACA and for Dreamers. I hope that I'm wrong on that. I want to say, as I look at what might be a legislative solution to this, that I do believe that walls are for cowards and that history is unkind to those who build walls to either keep people out or hold them in. I do remember a time when the Republican Party was cheering for a president who called for a wall to be torn down. And now they are cheering for a president who is doing everything he can to build one. And I am a historian. I can't wait to write that history. As I look at what legislative solutions we might find, I think the McCain-Coons bill is not a bad one to deal with DACA and the Dreamers, separate from any sort of, you know, garbage wall idea. The solution to a 21st century problem that we can border security without this ridiculous charade. I guess we shouldn't be surprised that we're seeing from President Trump.
And Dr. Gill.
I was at a DACA march on Saturday in Champaign. There were a couple hundred people out there on a very cold, windy day to march in support of a clean DACA bill. And I don't think there's any place for compromise on this one, Charlie. I travel around the 14 counties of this district, and I talk to a lot of people, not just left-of-center people. And I think that this issue has reached a level of heartlessness that goes beyond even everyday Republicans feel any comfort with. There might be some segment within their base that dislikes people just because their skin is brown or black, but this has gone too far. And the majority of people in America, the majority of people in Illinois 13 anyhow, recognize that these young people had promises made to them, and they have done nothing wrong by any definition of the word wrong, and this is the only home that they've ever known. And to turn our backs on them now is a travesty, a complete immoral act. And, you know, Frederick Douglass said that power concedes nothing without a demand. And I think on this one, we need to make a demand and stand by our demand because we are so right, and the majority of Americans understand that we're right.
Well, your responses have prompted another follow-up from me. They've been quite strong and full of your values. So the response, 30 seconds in the same order, starting with Eric Jones. Would you accept a government shutdown, as Republicans have stood for their values and shut down the government, over this particular issue?
So, you know, the framing of this has been that the Democrats forced the government shutdown over this issue. And I take issue with that because the Republican Party has had months to do something on this issue, to do something for the Dreamers. They've also had months to do something on the budget. Now, the most recent vote was for a short-term extension to allow the government to open for 3 weeks, that Senator Durbin and Senator Duckworth and a lot of representatives, the Democratic representatives across the country, endorsed. I would have been okay with that, but we can't let this keep going.
Okay. Angel Sides.
Yeah, I mean, I think they had plenty of time to do something as well. I think, if we have to shut down the government to get something done, then that's what we need to do. But I think first and foremost, we need to resolve this because the DACA recipients have always lived here. They consider this their home. I mean, it would be like, you know, one of us having to leave the United States. So
okay, thank you. You too would accept a shutdown. Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, your take on shutdown or not?
Yeah, I don't want a shutdown any more than anybody else. But the problem right now is that there's no trust. And there's no trust that this administration is going to move forward and protect the Dreamers. And so if that's the way, if there is no trust and this is the path that Republicans are forcing us down, then that's a path that they're going to force us down, and we have to stand up for our Dreamers.
Jonathan Eber.
Which is precisely what we should have done a couple of weeks ago. Back in 1995 and 1996, I was in the military when we shut down the government. Newt Gingrich shut down the government, I guess, because he had some dyspepsia or something like that. And then again in 1996, the same thing happened. At least in this case, there's a legitimate and just cause for this course of action. So I would absolutely support a government shutdown.
Okay, and Dr. Gill, you're the final take on this.
I think question. It's unanimous. Yes. No one wants to see a shutdown, but ultimately, if it comes to that, yes. And I agree with John. We should have held strong a couple of weeks ago. I'm endorsed by a couple of groups that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign, the Justice Democrats and Brand New Congress, because I stand for social justice. And if we won't stand up for these young people, then, you know, it makes you wonder what the heck we're all doing here, engaging in public policy debate.
This is Sound Ideas, and you're listening to 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. On this final question, we're going to curtail the answers to meet our time commitments, so you all have the full allotment for your closing. 1 minute answers instead of 90 seconds, please, on this one, and it should not be that complex. Greg Coos of Bloomington asks you to relate what you have personally done to lower your carbon footprint. So we'll start with Angel Sides.
I actually have solar panels on my house right now. And I do drive a 2005 Honda Civic Hybrid. It's kind of junky, but I bought it just because it's a hybrid. And I do recycle. I don't know. Can't think of anything else.
All righty, Betsy Dirksen.
I do everything I can. I can tell you that.
When we bought our house, it was old and needed a lot of updating, and so everything we did was to make sure that we were being environmentally sound. So I was trying to think through my head. We put in geothermal, and that's been excellent. We put in cork floors, which is a sustainable material. We did that with anything that we put into the house. We just made sure that it was a sustainable material. We have recycled carpet, recycled plastic bottles that are our carpet. And so we tried to, on a personal level, make sure that we were walking the walk and not just talking the talk, and teaching our children that decisions matter.
Jonathan, ixnay on the Arbon Cave.
So I count to 100 when I'm showering, and when I get to 100, I'm done. That's true. My daughters are watching on Facebook. They're streaming, and they can vouch for me. So it's that. I also ride my bicycle to work, and I take public transportation. The cost bar for entry into a green lifestyle is awfully high. We haven't been able to put solar panels on the house, although I would love to do that. We haven't been able to afford a hybrid car or an electric car. That's another thing that I would love to do. But this does point up the kind of economic justice side of the green movement that I think we need to address as a society, how it is that we can get people who aren't, who are living middle class and working class lives to be involved in green and renewable energies.
David Gill, your turn for the green living question.
Great question by Greg Coos. It speaks to the issue that is of paramount importance. We've talked about a lot of things about which I'm quite passionate, but climate change is up here and everything else has to be down here, because when we fail to do this right, there's not going to be human civilization left to fight about all the other issues that we've been talking about. I personally drove a Prius for 200,000 miles. I put three of my children into Priuses. I've put my wife into a hybrid vehicle. We recycle the giant bin. Every 2 weeks, they pick it up. And my first wife passed away many years ago, but she insisted that all of our paper products be bought from a company called Seventh Generation Recycled Paper, which doesn't feel good when you're blowing your nose. But the name Seventh Generation comes from an Iroquois saying that every public policy decision, you need to consider the impact seven generations down the road. Terrific, terrifically huge issue that needs dealing with.
And you get the last crack at that.
All right. I recycle as well. We make sure we save as much energy as we can in our household. And I will tell you, from a personal standpoint, I can actually talk about what I've done in my career, too. I was just endorsed by the League of Conservation Voters for the work that I have done on the environment personally. And that's what I want to talk about. I have gone after the Bush administration for the disinformation they put out on climate change, which is one of the biggest things we've dealt with in our country. I've also gone after the Bush administration for politicization of science, for ozone NACs, on and on and on. And I understand these issues because I spent a number of years working on them, and I know that when we're dealing with energy efficiency, that is one of the greatest wastes that we have, and that's why we live in our household We also turn out all the lights and take short showers and have replaced our windows too. The environment's important to me, and I've been fighting for it throughout my career.
And that answer moves us to our closing statements. We're going to go in reverse order from our opening statements, which means, Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, you may begin.
All right, thank you, and thank you again for hosting tonight. This has been fantastic. So, you know, what I want to leave you with is that I am a daughter of the 13th District. I'm a mother who's raised her family in the 13th District. I'm a student, a voter, a taxpayer, a worker, all right here in the 13th District. When you vote for me to send me to Washington, you should never have a concern about, is what she's saying really what she's going to do? Because it's the same thing I've always done. I am invested in our community and in our district because that's who I am. And I am the same Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan right here that I will be in D.C. fighting for all of us in the 13th and raising our voices in D.C.
And reverse order means Angel Sides goes next.
I have a family member that's addicted to heroin, and they overdosed, almost killing themselves three times. And I have checked into getting rehabilitation for this family member, and they wanted to put this family member on a months-long waiting list. So my dad just said there's not much help out there. We're just going to have to brace ourselves for this family member to not be with us any longer. But instead of doing that, I got signatures, and I was compelled because I was getting signatures kind of out of desperation, just not to go crazy, I guess. And I'm angry at our system. We have 64% of our discretionary spending goes to war. We're guarding the opium fields in Afghanistan. We look the other way to the heroin labs and Tajikistan.
Your time is up. 1 minute for Eric Jones.
You know, we've talked a lot about tonight about health care, about what we want to do in health insurance, on addressing climate change, on addressing our tax issues in this country, on infrastructure investment. But we can't forget what we're facing when we go to Congress in early 2019. And Donald Trump will still be president. And he has put somebody in charge of the EPA who doesn't believe in climate change. He's put somebody in charge of the Department of Education who does not believe in public education. He's dismantling the CFPB and all the financial protections put in place following the financial crisis. And he has also called his own Department of Justice the deep state. The house is on fire in Washington, and we need firefighters, and I have been fighting fires throughout my career. I have held an administration accountable before. I spent a number of years doing congressional investigations. I understand how that work is conducted, and I am ready to go do that work on day one for the people in this district.
David Gill, your closing remarks.
In closing, I'd like to mention a couple of conversations that I had recently. A reporter called me a couple weeks ago, and he said, Dr. Gill, what do you say to the criticism from the DCCC that we need a fresh face in the district? And I told him, and I'll tell you tonight, that we've had a fresh face. I haven't run for this seat for 6 years. I came within 0.3 of 1 point of beating Rodney Davis. My message won, but for that liberal independent. And then I stepped aside so that they could run a fresh face. And I watched another fresh face in 2016. I've watched those individuals lose by 50 to 60 times what I lost by. I can't keep standing aside for fresh faces. Last week, I was in Piatt County, and a woman said to me, Dr. Gill, I love what you stand for. I love where you're at on all the issues, but I worry, are you too radical to win? And I told her, no. I said, look at the numbers. We still have real facts in this world. 0.3 of 1 point is a lot less than 18 to 20 points. And now with a two-person race, I can eliminate Rodney Davis from Washington, D.C.
Thank you. Jonathan Ebel, your last word.
So for a long time, Illinois has had the reputation as a place where ethics come to die. And this is unfair. As I've been circulating in the district, I've met lots and lots of people who are working very hard to do the right thing. What's been going on is we haven't been served well by our elected officials and the political system that put them in place, whether it's Rodney Davis or Rod Blagojevich. Now, There are two ways forward here. We can either never again elect somebody named Rodney, or we can try to bring new faces and new perspectives into the conversation. If you privilege me with this job, I will serve you faithfully. If you privilege me with this job, I will work every day to bend the power of this great nation to bring Medicare for all to be the law of the land, to protect workers' rights, women's rights, and civil rights, and to protect the environment that is right now in peril. I ask you to please send me. Thank you.
Thank you, candidates, for participating in this live on-location edition of Sound Ideas and 13th District Congressional Candidate Forum, co-sponsored with the McLean County League of Women Voters, Illinois State University College Democrats, the ISU School of Communication, and the Historic Norma Theater. WGLT.org is where you can find this episode of Sound Ideas with help from broadcast technologist Travis Metters, events and outreach director Linda Healy, digital director Ryan Denham, chief announcer Laura Kennedy, program director Mike McCurdy, and our timekeepers Reagan Rinciuso and Becky Grapp of the League of Women Voters. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The primary is March 20th. Go vote in whatever party ballot you choose, but vote. Thanks to you for attending and listening. This is WGLT Normal, a service of Illinois State University.